And first, I'd like to introduce and welcome David Pepley.
I tried to warn him, but he's still here.
So you're here for a while, and you have to bear with us. Good luck. I'd like to hold a couple of public hearings and maybe a work session or two if we can work it out. I'd like to open a public hearing on Gospel 2179. Yes. James, would you like to present it for us?
Gospel 2179A relates to the Natural Heritage Program. The Oregon Natural Heritage Program is a cooperative effort to catalog Oregon's natural resources in a databank. The databank has been operated by the Nature Conservancy in partnership with the Division of State Lands. It's been around since the mid-70s. The databank was transferred to the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University in 2002. The bill facilitates the permanent transfer of the Natural Resources Databank to Oregon State University. It also limits entries into the databank by university employees assigned to the Natural Heritage Program and with the permission of the owner of the land on which the natural resources exist. It creates no expenditure impact that has not already been included in the governor's recommended budget for the agency.
Thank you. Questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Morgan.
Just some historical background here. We transferred over the program to the Natural Resource Institute at Oregon State in the last session. Ms. James, can you give us some background on what the discussions were at that time around future funding for the program?
I'm sorry, I don't have that available with me today. I can get it for you.
If you could, I would appreciate it.
It could be that Jeanette has that information. She's in the audience.
She's got a big smile. That's good.
Well, if I might, Mr. Chair, I'm reading the fiscal analysis, and there's a piece in here that says the Legislative Assembly appropriated $100,000 general fund as seed money for OSU's operation of the databank with the expectation the operational cost of the Natural Heritage Program would be covered within the Oregon University System budget in the 2003-2005 biennium. And I'm on the, under comments, the last sentence in the second paragraph.
Jeanette, would you like to come forward? You're my one and only sign-up anyway, so the time is perfect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeanette Holman from the Division of State Lands. Last session, Representative Morgan, to your question, there was a budget note in both the DSL budget and in, I believe it was OSU's budget, or OUS's budget, directing us to transfer the program, and that's where the language about directing OUS to include it in their budget for this biennium was, it was in the budget note. I think it was on 5014, which was the Christmas tree bill. I think, from last session.
What was in the Christmas tree bill?
The $100,000 appropriation to OSU was in there with the budget note directing them to include the funding for the program in the Oregon University System budget for the ongoing bienniums.
Okay. So then, with the introduction of this bill, do we assume that the budget note is not being complied with?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, this bill, what we did over the biennium was transfer it by interagency agreement. This bill makes that transfer permanent to make through the statutes so that we can not do the interagency agreement any longer.
It was not shifted by law last session, just by interagency agreement.
Okay, so there is no funding attached to this bill at all?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to take up where Representative Morgan left off and try to get on the record whether or not there's going to be any expectation of funding once the interagency agreement is superseded by statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's my understanding that funding has been included in the OUS budget.
Well, Mr. Chair, when you say included in the OUS budget, from existing OUS resources?
I don't know the answer to that.
I'll check on it. Mr. Chair, that I think would be a threshold issue for me to know the answer to before I could feel that I could responsibly vote on this.
Judy, is there any chance we could clarify that?
Let me see if I can find it.
Okay. Because I would, if we can, I'd like to pass this out today.
Other questions before I...
It would probably be Steve Bender.
Yeah, I'll check with Steve.
Yeah, should we just stand at ease? Well,
we can have Jeanette testify.
Oh, that would work.
Sure.
Mr. Chair,
remember that a clever idea, though?
We've covered most of my testimony. This process started of transferring the data bank in, well, I was still at Legislative Council, so I believe it was in the 1999 session when talks started on it. And then last session they continued, and I was very, very pleased when we got the MOU a year ago, transferring that part of the program down to OSU. In the past, the entire Natural Heritage Program has been run through the Nature Conservancy, through an agreement with the Division of State Lands, and it was felt that putting the program either into an agency or into the university system would help make it more accessible to state agencies, local governments, federal agencies, and citizens who want to use the information that's found in it. So we brought this bill.
David, you'd like to come up to the table?
Sure. To make that transfer permanent so we could not have to continuously renew the interagency agreement.
I'm Steve Bender, Legislative Fiscal Office. I wasn't watching this channel.
Representative Johnson, would you like to restate your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bender, the question arises out of now that the interagency agreement is being superseded by statute, is there any expectation in the future that any funding would follow this transfer, or would costs to maintain and operate the data bank be absorbed by the OUS system?
There is a specific amount in the governor's recommended budget for higher ed for 2003-05 for OUS's natural heritage programs. Responsibilities. That amount was approximately $105,000. We had heard earlier that OUS had some confusion as to whether there were funds in their budget for this program or not, and we verified to them that there were. It was something that the governor specifically added. The budget is $100,000 higher than it would have been if the governor had not added that. We let them know about this, and they are now aware of it and have informed the Legislative Fiscal Office that they will not need to curtail or eliminate that program, that they do understand that the funding is there for it.
One last follow-up. The logical question then is the expectation for future biennia?
It would now be in their base budget unless it were removed at some future time by the legislature. So there would basically be $100,000 in the budget for higher ed from this point forward, adjusted for the general inflationary types of adjustments that we have.
I lied. I got one more.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. $100,000 is a significant amount of money. What all is entailed in the maintenance of a data bank?
I cannot answer all that question for you. I do know that the legislature last session identified $100,000 in funding to be transferred to OSU for that particular program. And that is what the governor's budget did. That's what the co-chair's budget maintains. And we have heard from Oregon State University that they will not curtail that program.
Okay. Representative Mark.
Mr. Bender, I believe that you mentioned that there was $105,000 in the budget. Is the $5,000 related to some kind of roll-up cost for the program?
Yes.
I would ask then that we take a look at that in light of the fact that we are building budgets with the assumption that there won't be any roll-ups.
The Education Subcommittee has approved reducing general reduction in the amount of inflationary roll-ups that were allowed system-wide, though that was not strictly supplied on a program-by-program basis.
So, but the reductions would be applied to that amount also?
Presumably, yes.
Sorry.
They're apparently watching you. Oh.
It's very frightening.
It's kind of a scary thought. But we're getting used to it. It's happened to us a time or two as well.
Well, and Mr. Chair, perhaps Ms. Holman could address Representative Johnson's question about what went with the program that costs $100,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the kinds of things that the money goes for in part is match. They get some federal, a fair amount of federal money to run the program. It goes for staff time in updating the database with new information as it comes in, paying, well, they don't pay for the database or the software anymore. Primarily, it's the staff time for people to go out and collect the information. They record it and put it in the same format as every other, you know, as the database is in, because they get it from all sorts of places. A lot of federal agencies send information to this database. And they also use some of their time to make the information available to developers or local governments or state agencies that need to know what kinds of species or what kinds of areas they're proposing to do work in.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying to reconcile is $100,000 of general fund when we're scouring these budgets. This is a program, and I understand the value of it, but when you say that it would help developers understand species that might be in a certain area, I'm just trying to understand in a budget cycle where we're doing some really extraordinary things to lots of programs, I'm wondering, is there any option for fee-for-service to help fund this? Were I a developer, I would be very pleased to go someplace and find all of the data amalgamated in a single source, and it would certainly make my permitting relationship with the other agencies more streamlined, I should imagine. But that would also be a service that I'd be willing to pay for. And I'm trying to gauge whether or not this is just something the general fund is expected to support in perpetuity, or whether there's any option for a new line of thinking about how it would be paid for, depending on who the beneficiaries are.
Senator Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe they do some pay for service already. I don't know if that charge that they do actually covers all of the costs of providing the information, but they do it now, and I suspect that OSU is going to have them do more of it.
Mr. Chair, I'd comment too that the appropriation side of the issue is in the Education Subcommittee and not really subject to the discussion that we're having right here.
That's
so
true.
These are issues that could be dealt with in that venue.
True. I do have one more question that might be in the gray area. I believe that OWEB has done a lot of work in this past biennium of gathering information and putting it in the right format so that it could be compiled for the Natural Heritage Program. Do either you, Mr. Bender, or Holman, know, are you aware of any OWEB funding that's helping to maintain this program as well?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any of this biennium, but once they left and went down to OSU, I don't know. And I don't also know whether TNC got funding from OWEB, but I'm not aware of any of this biennium.
Bender, are you aware of any funding?
I am not aware either.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson.
You've asked half the question. Maybe the other half of the question would be, and I would have to defer to people with more expertise in what all the OWEB money could be used for, would this be a candidate for a OWEB investment?
I would think that would be difficult, Representative, but maybe you have better information.
What do you have?
legislation right here in front of us.
Wait a long time. I started going through the categories of what you can fund with OWEB money, and there may be some instances where they could help fund a survey or things like that on the ground, but I'd have to look to be sure.
It would seem to me, Mr. Chair, to be tied to habitat restoration or water quality issues, and that may be a stretch.
The habitat restoration, maybe to find out what species were there. Maybe they could get some funding that way.
I think it would have to be tied to a project.
Yes.
What you're
mm-hmm.
saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Did you have more to
No, because I think we pretty much covered what's in my written testimony and what I was going to say. If you have questions, I'll...
Okay. Any other questions? Committee. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? If not, we'll close the public hearing. Let me just poll the committee. Are we ready for a work session?
Well, we have a problem.
Well, she's right outside.
Oh. I'm going to open the work session for
Mr. Chair.
House Bill 2179A.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2179A be referred to the Full Ways and Means Committee with a do pass recommendation.
Yeah. Senator, we have a motion.
I'm sure it's a good one.
To move this bill forward, right? Committee, is there discussion of the motion? The objection to the motion? Motion carries. Carriers. No volunteers?
Krieger.
Krieger worked with me very hard our last meeting. I'm going to ask Representative Johnson to carry this bill on the House, and this is a good bill, and on the floor, please.
With your acknowledgement that this is a good bill, I will accept that responsibility, Mr. Chair.
And you'll be proud to carry this bill.
I'll carry it.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 2253. House Bill 2253A. Ms. James?
2253A, it relates to State Division of State Lands fees. Division of State Lands manages state-owned lands, including lands underlying waterways of the state, for the benefit of the Common School Fund. Fee revenues from the mining of aggregate and other activities on wetlands and waterways of the state generate significant contributions to the Lacumen School Fund, but a large portion of these revenues are currently used to support the removal fill permit program. The current fee structure provides only between 12% and 15% of the cost of operating the program. The proposed fee schedule simplifies the structure and increases the fees to bring the cost of the program covered by fees to approximately 24%, so reduce program reliance on the Common School Fund. Some major changes in the proposed fee schedule include increasing the base fee for permits to $300 for up to 10,000 cubic yards of material. So that's an annual renewal fee of $300. Expands the span of the volume fee from $800 for 1,000 to 5,000 cubic yards of material to $2,500 for large projects of 25,000 cubic yards or more. Clarifies the fee for emergency authorizations, allows the division to assess a fee for general authorizations of up to $150. It also combines the removal fill volume fees into one schedule ranging from nothing for volumes up to 1,000 cubic yards to $1,000 plus the actual cost of processing the permit application for volumes that are over 10,000 cubic yards. The bill would also require a fee for riprap and erosion control projects, but exempts habitat restoration projects from fees.
Okay, thank you. Questions from committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know whether it's best to ask the committee staff or whether it would be better to ask the division how the fee structure was arrived at.
You better to ask them. They were the ones put it together.
Why don't we ask, is there any other questions of staff? Ms. Hannes, Ann Hannes, and John Lilly, please.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Hannis, Director of the Division of State Lands, and with me is John Lilly, who's the Assistant Director of the Division of State Lands. House Bill 2253 restructures and increases our removal fill permit application fees. The revenue generated from the fees help to defray permit processing and other program-related costs to the Common School Fund. The last time fees were increased was 14 years ago in 1989. With the increase in 1989, the percentage of the program covered by fees went from 17% to 40%. Now, currently, fees generate around $400,000 and cover less than 15% of the cost of the program. And over the years, the costs have risen, but our revenues have remained static. Some of the key policy questions are: how much should permit applicants contribute to support the removal fill program and offset the impact of the Common School Fund? What percentage of the cost should be covered by applicants? Prior to this job, I worked at the Oregon Department of Forestry, and there, for example, forest landowners pay 40% of the cost of the Forest Practices Program. This fee increase, as Ms. James mentioned, would cover about 24%, up from what I said was less than 15%. And then another question is, other revenues from our statutory programs help support the program, but would then go into the Common School Fund. So how much should we free up to go to the Common School Fund? When we submitted a fee increase to the legislature 2 years ago in 2001, we were asked to go back and restructure our fees. We've done that by working with stakeholders and by taking a hard look at the fee structure that we have and who's paying. We have worked out issues that were raised by the miners, OCAPA, and the counties, and we understand, hearing back from them, that House Bill 2253 with the proposed amendments is now supported by the Independent Miners Association and OCAPA. We've also heard that the counties are now not opposed to the bill. Let me turn to John Lilly, and he can go over the details with you.
Thank you. I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we started out on this piece of legislation during the interim, we attempted to look at a total restructuring of the way our fee system was established. There were a number of permits or authorizations that were issued at no cost, and there were various aspects of the program that appeared to be to promote some inequity between users. As a result, in addition to the fact that there was a lower and lower percentage of the operating costs of the program being borne by the applicants themselves. So what we did was we sampled, we took a sample of our permits from a particular fiscal year, biennium rather, and looked at the volumetric amounts in total, how much removal, how much fill for each, for the permit, combined those together, and then decided that we would treat all applicants in the same fashion. In fact, in other words, if it was a private operator, a contractor would pay the same for their impact as a city or a county, or a private developer or a private property owner, whoever. So we try to bring some equality to the approach of the fee structure in that way. Then we looked at attempting to derive more of the cost of the program, in other words, more greater cost responsibility from the applicants themselves. And originally, our goal was to try to reach something in the neighborhood of where we were in 1989 when the last adjustment was made. In other words, trying to get up to about 40% of the cost of the program recovered from fees. And that became clear very quickly that that would be a very steep increase in fees and probably beyond what we would feel comfortable coming before you on, and I'm sure it would probably have filled this room, or we would never would have gotten as far as we have today. So with that in mind, we ratcheted back to what we felt was a more comfortable, more appropriate level of increase, although it is still an increase over what we had established in 1989. And that's how we ended up where we are initially. Now, I have to point out that the bill has changed since it was originally introduced and heard by the House Substantive Committee. One of the objections to the bill earlier was a provision for cost, what we call cost recovery. We get a certain number of projects, not lots of them, but a number of projects that are very large in the total volume of material removed. And so we said, well, those are greater impacts, therefore we spend more time, or at least that was kind of the thinking, and therefore we should charge based upon the amount of time we put into those on a cost recovery basis. The counties and OCAPA, the Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association, and others came before the House Committee and objected to those provisions. And so we backed off and established categories of fee based upon the volumes. And these are total volumes, removals and fills totaled together. So what we have now is a provision that makes the base fee the same, $300 for individual removal fill permits, and then a 1,000 to 5,000 or up to 1,000 yards is no volume fee, and that's about half of our permits are under 1,000 yards. And then after that, we go from 1,000 to 5,000 yards at $800 plus the base fee, and there's about 28% of our total permits are made up of permits of that volume. Greater than 5,000 up to 10,000 yards would be $1,050, with about 9% of our projects falling in that category. And after that, we began just grading out or breaking up the volumes according to 5,000-yard jumps and just categorizing or moving the rate up accordingly by that amount. No one would pay more than $2,500 for their volume fee because at 25,000 yards and more, it's fixed at $2,500. Some other changes that are in here are that...
Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Morgan.
It appears that there are... What I'm looking at is the examples that you have in the back. And the one, there's example F, which is development on 15 acres of wetland that involves 100,000 cubic yards of fill. And the fee goes, if I'm reading this correctly, from $600 to $2,800. That is pretty hefty increase in the fee. And I'm curious about... what the feedback is that you got from the people that are in the business where they would be developing on this large of a scale.
Chair, Representative Morgan, I picked this example because it's representative of a situation we encountered not long ago when a major silicon wafer industry moved into Lane County and proposed a project just in this order of magnitude. We spent an enormous amount of staff time working that project, and the return in return we were able to charge a fee of $600 for a project that was in the millions of dollars of capital investment. I would guess that the this fee, even the increase in fee from $600 to $2,800, would not be an impediment to the development. Even if this development were, for example, a residential development or a commercial development of the scale of this acreage.
If this is a commercial development, I can clearly see one site, one permit. If this was a residential development, would they fall into this category, or would they be getting permits for each site in each residential site?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if the developer were coming in and saying he or she were developing a 40-acre site and 15 of that were wetlands, they would be laying out a road. They would be laying out possibly doing some fill in the wetlands in order to create cul-de-sacs or what have you that associate with that development. We would issue a permit for that development and the associated impacts with the road development, the sewer lines, and all that kind of when each individual property owner were to buy a property, and if their property included a portion of a wetland, then they would get an individual permit at that time if they exceeded 50 yards of impact or if they were building in the wetland at all. Typically, in fact, Mr. Turnick was here week before last, I believe, and spoke about a subdivision development he's doing. And his in his plan, he worked with the developer to avoid the wetlands as much as possible and leave a portion of each lot sufficient for a building footprint to occur and for the driveway, et cetera, so that a property owner might be able to build on that lot without having to, by being able to avoid the wetland and therefore avoiding the cost of a permit.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, John. I thought I heard you say it, and I thought I must have heard wrong, and then I'm looking through your examples. If I was dredging material out of a channel or out of a waterway and placing it for a fill in the waterway, am I charged for both functions?
Chair, under this fee structure, you'd pay your fee based upon the total volume removed and placed in the waterway. So if you took 5,000 yards out and you put 5,000 yards in someplace else, that would be 10,000 yards of total impact, and your fee would be based upon that.
So you pay both ways?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I just have to ask this question. What does the applicant or the fee payer get for this expenditure, and what does the state gain from these expenditures?
Mr. Chair, fundamentally, the applicant, of course, receives a permit. They receive the authorization to do work in waters and wetlands of the state, and the assurance that the division will stand behind the permit that's issued and defend that against all comers. And they receive the assurance that they're doing it in a manner that conserves and protects as much as possible under the law the water resources of the state, which is the fundamental purpose of the removal fill law. What the division obtains is compensation for time spent to issue that permit. I think in this case, when we're talking about cost responsibility, we're basically shifting some of the funds that are underwriting the program from the statutory revenue sources such as sand and gravel royalties, et cetera, to the common school fund, so that the users of the program, in this case permit applicants, loosely speaking, are paying for what the service is being rendered.
Let me expand that question just a little bit. If this material, if the project is in navigable waters, the applicant would pay a removal fee, a royalty fee, and a fill fee?
Mr. Chair, if the applicant is taking material from a state-owned waterway, as you say, and they take 5,000 yards out, and they redeposit that in the same waterway, then the permit fee would be based upon the putting and the taking, 10,000 yards. If they were using that fill in the waterway for some commercial purpose, which is kind of hard for me to sort out, then they would pay a royalty to the state because the material is state-owned. And under the state's proprietary responsibility, we charge royalties for use of those materials when they're put to commercial, when they become an article of commerce. The more common situation would not be the one you described precisely, but it would be one where a person removes 10,000 yards and places it on upland, for example, to use for fill in a low area to bring it up to grade for some reason, and then builds on it. That would be an article of commerce. And therein, under the land board's regulations, we would charge a fee for the material when it was used for fill as an article of commerce, and then we would charge the removal permit fees to cover the cost of issuing the removal fill permit.
Give me a way out here for you. I'm on a state waterway. I want to
clean a channel.
For drainage purposes or maybe even irrigation purposes. And so I take the material out of the state waterway. I put it on a dike or I level it out into some of the, if you're allowed to do what, 4 inches or 2 inches, something like that. And I use this property as agriculture for whatever reason. I do get benefit from that. Would I be paying three ways in?
Mr. Chair, under the description you gave me, I would not consider the material removed and placed on the pasture as an article of commerce. So your fee would be based upon, in the first place, if it's simply maintaining a channel, an irrigation canal or a drainage channel, that's not regulated. So you wouldn't be seeing us for the purposes of the removal fill permit. If you were working behind a tide gate, we have a general authorization that allows cleaning a sediment from behind a tide gate because oftentimes the material is placed on upland in wetland. And we have, as you know, a general authorization for that. If this bill were to pass, then the maximum one would pay for that permit would be $150. We've established that fee by administrative rule. Currently, there is no fee for that work.
Okay. Other questions of committee?
Mr. Chair, I have concerns over the level of some of the increases here. In my bill file, I have a letter from Dave Babbitts that Thompson's Mills has come forward to you. And he talks in here about having to get an annual permit. It says, I'm equally sure that you are not aware that these fee increases will jump us from the current $50 per year to $1,100 annually in order to renew our removal permit. I'm fully cognizant of the fact that the state of Oregon is in a pinch for funds, but I think I can safely say that we're short of cash flow just as well. It does not seem reasonable to require such a huge increase in fees we are required to pay, particularly when the permit has been reviewed every year for the last 20 or so years with little or no changes during that time. So, I have misgivings about unleashing these kinds of increases on people, especially for renewal permits where there's very little staff time that's involved in going over the permits. This is between a rock and a hard place because we have to pay for the staff time to go through the permits. We have to do what we can to streamline the processing times. And we have to get the permits out the door in a timely way. But, you know, going from a $600 permit to a $2,500 permit, going from a $300 permit to a $1,350 permit, these are huge increases.
You want to comment?
Mr. Chair, I would say that, yes, they are big increases on paper. I think one has to look at the fact that the rate has been the same since 1989. We've been unable to raise the fees in that time. If the fee had been tied to inflation, for example, and inflation was at 3% compounded, under example A, the $225 fee would have been $330, which is $30 more than what we're proposing in this adjustment, which is, as I said before, over almost half of the permits that we issue are in this less than 1,000-yard range. It is a big increase. There's no question. On paper, it is big. In part, it's because of the fact that the fee hasn't been changed in a long time, and as a result, it's going to hit folks. In terms of renewals, the renewal fee would be based upon the base fee. If there was a new permit required, then the full fee would be required, both the base and the volume fee. It may be possible in Mr. Babbitt's situation that maybe a longer term a longer term permit could be available so that he wasn't back into the, as he believes, back into the permit grind every 4 or 5 years. There are options that we could work out, but I can't deny that there will be an increase, in some cases a large increase for some folks. One thing is that frequently operators, folks who do work in wetlands and waterways, basically it's not a frequent operation. Mr. Babbitt is probably an exception to the rule, because most folks, when they do their work in, to fill a wetland, they're not back again in 5 years to do the same work again. It turns out to be a cost of doing business.
Is there potential for a situation like Mr. Babbitt to take this back and rework it? I mean, I'm having trouble seeing where you could incur that much cost as well. I understand that. Does he have, another question would be along the same line, does he have the ability now to get an extended permit?
Mr. Chair, yes, he does.
And why wouldn't he want to do that?
May not be aware of that possibility. We may not have considered that possibility in the past because.
With an extended permit, what exactly are we talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, a longer term for the permit.
And what's the cost of it? Is the cost of it the same as the cost of a 1 year permit?
Mr. Chair, no, it would not, under the current rule law, it is not, nor under this proposal would it be either. When you go back through the permitting process, it's as if you start over again. So when the permit expires, which most of them have a term limit, say 1 year or 5 years or more, depending upon the activity. Remember, I did say that a lot of these are project-oriented works where someone is doing a new erosion control project on their stream bank, and they expect to do it once and not have to come back for another 20 years. Or they're filling in a wetland to build a new retail building or something, and they're not expecting to come back and have to do permitting again. But in the case of a situation like a person who has a channel or point bars on a river or a canal where they need to remove those periodically to maintain the flow, they are going to come back on a periodic basis because of that work. And if we're able to, say, issue a permit for a longer period of time, then they don't have to go through the elongated permitting process. You know, they have a longer contract, so to speak, rather than having a 3-year contract. Maybe it's a 10-year contract.
Well, I think that is worthwhile to look into. The question I had was, you know, if you get a 5-year permit, but it costs you 5 times as much as a 1-year permit, that was what I was trying to get some information on, whether getting an extended permit is actually less permitting fee than just getting a 1-year permit.
Mr. Chair, the answer would be yes. If you just get a 1-year permit, then at the expiration date of that permit, you're going to be back into the permit process again and paying the volume fee and the base fee again. If you have a 5-year permit, then your permit doesn't expire for 5 years, and as a result, you're able to continue to do the work that you need to do in the intervening time.
And does the 5-year permit cost 5 times as much as the 1-year permit?
No, it does not.
What is multiple? I'm a little confused here, too. When you go to a multi-year contract, how do you establish the additional fee then?
Mr. Chair, under this bill, the multiple-year fee or multiple-year permit would be the base fee plus the volume fee 1 time. And each year after that, each year it's in place, it will be $300 base. The base fee would be paid each year that the permit is in place. So you wouldn't have the volume fee. You pay the volume fee once.
But why do you need the base fee every year?
The theory is that it's covering the cost of processing the renewal in that time.
Plus, there are also costs like monitoring and others that we engage in during the time.
Yeah, that's the correct answer.
So you, getting kind of technical here, but I think it's important we clear this. You have staff that monitors these permits on a yearly basis or oftener?
We have staff that monitor the permits. We also, I mean, there are functions that we perform that we don't charge a fee that's really all wrapped into the program costs. For example, if someone comes in and does a wetland, wants a wetland determination or delineation, that we help them out on that. We don't charge a fee for that. The monitoring is not charged separately, for example, is another example.
Representative Johnson.
Just as a point of clarification, I thought when you sat down, Ms. Hannison, began your testimony, one of the two of you said that at this point this has been negotiated with industry and the counties are on board at this point. Did I hear you correctly?
I said the counties are not opposed to it.
Okay.
Right. And I said that OCAPA was on board with it, as was the independent miners.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Craig, you got that look.
Mr. Chair, I was watching and listening to this over the last few minutes. I have the same concerns that Morgan has about those increases and whether it be a $300 base fee every year on a 5-year permit. We'll see what those expenses are. I've been reading this for somewhat uncomfortable with where we're going.
Any further statements? Representative Johnson?
I don't know, Mr. Chair, whether or not I'm comparing apples and oranges, but I recall the agency sitting here testifying to this committee previously, talking about the agency's inability to do appropriate enforcement in some of your programmatic areas. And we have trespassers and towers built on state property that none of us know about, and your inability to get out and check up on state properties that are in your portfolio of responsibilities. It seems to me that part of the direction where you're headed with this fee increase that hasn't been changed since the 80s is to have adequate people to be able to go out and make sure that the terms of the permits are being adhered to, and that appropriate behavior is behavior commensurate with the permit is ongoing. I'm supportive of a program that allows you the appropriate personnel to go out and make sure that you're discharging your responsibility with respect to state property. Have I missed something?
Mr. Representative Johnson, you're correct. I mean, what we're trying to do is to cover as much of the cost as we can with fees, because otherwise it drains it away from the common school fund that might otherwise go to schools. There's a lot of things involved with a permit, not just the processing of the permit and looking over the information. It's the monitoring, it's the enforcement, it's the reviewing the permit, providing technical assistance, helping out somebody in a pre-application conference, helping them out in advance to provide them information about the program and to allow them to configure their project such that it minimizes the impact that is not just covered in the actual processing of the application itself. So when you look at the fee, it seems like a large amount just to process that application, but there's much that is involved with that, such as that enforcement and monitoring aspects of it.
And follow-ups, Representative?
Yes, sir.
Representative Morgan?
Can you show us where in the bill it talks about permits that are for extended periods of time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I think at least one place would be on in Section 1 on page 3, beginning in line 8, where it speaks to the anniversary date of each permit. But directly to your question, that's not a the term of the permit, in other words, the length of time that the permit is in place, is not covered in this particular section. That's in another section of law and in our administrative rules, where we have the flexibility to offer a multi-year permit, and which is a prudent thing to do when you're dealing with projects that are recurring frequently or annually, such as sand and gravel removal for commercial mining or maintenance of infrequent but periodic maintenance of an access channel to a marina.
And do you currently offer those permits on a multi-year basis?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other question I have is, if the increases are implemented, how long do you anticipate it will be before you will be coming back to ask for more money?
I guess...
Now, Jeanette, why are you smiling? You're loving this, aren't you?
You know, I can't answer that because, one, I'm taking it one step at a time in terms of this particular fee increase. It's been so long since we've had an increase. We'll have to look at, as a policy question, when we do our budgets each time, is what are the costs of the program, what's the impact on the common school fund, and, you know, what's the correct balance?
Okay, so given you haven't been able to take historical data about the number of permits that you process in a given time and project out in the future how long it will be until the money that you're pulling in from the increase in permit fees will be used up?
We can project out in terms of what our general level of activity is. Now, it goes up and down depending on the economy. You know, what we do know is that if this fee increase passes, then it's going to cover 24% of the program. That'll be a question for future years to look at, you know, what level of the program should be covered by fees and permits, given that money that that goes into the cost of the program could have gone into the common school fund. So there's a policy question there.
Okay. I have one more question.
Follow up.
Do any of the funds that are generated by the fee increase get applied to portions of your program that are outside the venue of the permits?
Senator Meserly, Representative Morgan, it really all goes into the same pot, if you will. It all goes into the common school fund. The money that generally pay for statutory programs for the common school fund are the ones that are used for paying for the removal field program. Go ahead, John.
Representative Morgan, I think I know what you're interested in. I would say that all of these, the everything that we're doing in the removal fill program and the and in the wetlands program that's related to identifying wetlands and helping development to avoid them or to mitigate for them, etc., is all interrelated to the removal fill permitting program, period. There is this fee increase would not be used for to underwrite some kind of extraneous operation that doesn't have a direct correlation to the and a direct support of the removal fill permitting process.
Can I ask one more question? Does any portion of the, or would any portion of the funding that's generated be used for programs that are outside of the issuing and administration of the permits?
I can't see. I mean, given that it doesn't cover the full cost of the program anyway, it would be going to support the program. I don't. You know, it would not be used, for example, to pay for costs related to the Elliott State Forest. That's what.
Because you're only covering 25% of the cost.
Okay.
Senator Krieger, I'd like to ask one question first. If someone does not comply with their permit, what is the penalty?
Let me have John. It will.
I'm sorry. I'm not versed on that one.
It depends on the nature of the violation. There's a formula that's used that we can get for you. It depends on whether or not they've been a violator in the past, whether or not they agree to take actions and enter into a consent order. So it's wrapped up into a variety of factors that determine what a penalty might be, a civil penalty might be.
But what is the range we're looking at?
What is it? No more than three.
I didn't.
We'll get you the schedule for that.
Right, where I'm going for this, and I just want to lay this out here, that I'll just be real blunt about it. It looks to me like that we're trying to operate these programs on a command and control basis, where we'd have other permitting agencies in the state who operate more on a much simpler basis, but there's a penalty if someone steps out of bounds. And it's much easier and much less costly to function and to provide the same service and the same protection for the state's waters or to the state. And has the department had a thorough discussion of how we do these kind of things, how we administer a program such as this?
Well, first of all, we want to work as cooperatively with an individual as possible. So we encourage people that if they're thinking of a project, to come and talk to us up front so we can work with them and we can make that project such that it will avoid or minimize the impact on the resource, but it also will reduce costs for them. So up front, we'd like to work with them in a cooperative way, and our approach is to try to do that throughout the process. When we find a violation, then we try to first see if there's anything that can be done to try to repair the damage or to make it, restore it to how it was. So we'd rather do that first before we automatically issue penalties. But we will issue penalties in order to enforce the program.
Mr. Chair, if I may, on a follow-up. In the 2001-2002 fiscal year, we received $9,500 total during the entire fiscal year for civil penalties. And that's resolving something in the neighborhood of 100 or so cases.
But what was that number again?
9,581 during the 2001-2002 fiscal year. The prior year, in 2001, there was higher, $52,000 in civil penalty payments. The year before that, 1999-2000, the total amount paid in civil penalties was $2,750. The amount of civil penalties vary, obviously, from year to year because of the nature of the violation and either the numbers or the volumes involved. The volumes in terms of cases handled and resolved during those 3 years is pretty much the same. But in magnitude, in relationship to the number of permits that we issue, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 900 more like 1,000 a year or so, and the number of cases that we resolve that are compliance issues, we're talking about 9,000, a high of $52,000 and a low of $2,000 in a particular fiscal year for civil penalties.
Well, I'm, to sum up my concern, what we want is compliance, and if we can figure out an easier, cheaper way, both for the applicant and the department to get there. Representative Krieger?
Mr. Chair, you have an example in here, Ann, about Judge Chancellor Marinas, and I'm thinking about the different flood events we have on the coast where all of our coastal boat basins, channels, every 3 or 4 years there's major work that needs to be done, and I don't even know how many of them get all the permits they need because some got their own little dredges, but it goes from 300 to 1350, for instance, for only 7,500 yards.
I would guess that during these type of events, they have other type damages around the boat bases too, and marinas that increase their costs that they have no way of recouping or increasing their income. These small boat bases, whether it be Brookings or Portico, Keeler, or Bann, or whatever it might be, it seems to me like this could be, Senator, pretty major thing for some of these small areas, especially where we're getting away now from having some of the federal dredging that takes place. And also, what do you do about the federal dredging and or one, you know, the federal dredging takes place to a certain point. From that point on, it's done by the port or a private individual or a contractor. Responsible for what? As far as those costs.
Yeah, I can try.
John, answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, when the federal government or a contractor of the federal government is operating under the auspices of the federal government, is working to maintain a congressionally designated and authorized navigation channel, we do not regulate that dredging fill. However, since they're often taking material from the bed of a publicly owned waterway, and the Division of State Lands does manage those publicly owned waterways, if they place that material on upland and use it, and it's used as an article of commerce, then we charge a royalty for that, and that royalty then is statutory revenue that goes into the common school fund. Interestingly, we have a pretty good business operation going on down in St. Helens, where the Corps is dumping sand in a particular area that we've mutually designated, and then we have an operator who sells that sand out to all comers. As a business, and we get the royalty from that operation, provides jobs for some folks in the local community, and the operator then derives some income from the sale of those and the operation of that stockpile.
Or in a boat basin, a port district, they got the permit to do the dredging, then they could sell the dredging, but you would get a fee for the dredging, and then you get a fee for the sale of the material.
That's correct. If the boat basin were dredged and the material placed on the upland, and later then the port were to be selling that, then we would charge a royalty, which I believe on the South Coast is somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 cents a yard. And I'm sure it's worth 10 times that when it's going out down the road. But at any rate, there would be an article of commerce if it's hauled off, and there would be a royalty paid to the common school fund because of that material being publicly owned material.
Okay. Before I go to Representative Morgan, on your page 2 of your presentation, you talk about Phil's... The bullet point 2 increases the base fee to $300 for most applicants, reduces it for others. Example fills by public and commercial operators. Explain what we're doing there and how much does it reduce and why.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the current law, a fill by a public body, the base fee is $375.
And it's by commercial operator too.
I want to make sure I get this right. Yes, the base fee for a public body for a fill is $375, and a fill by a commercial operator is $375. And a commercial operator is any person undertaking a project having financial profit as a goal. The public body is a federal, state, or local government body, unless specifically exempted by law, engaged in projects for purpose of providing free public access.
So you've made all of them 300?
Yes, sir.
Yes. That's where, when we took a look at this and we mentioned the equity issue, we tried to approach it from that standpoint, too.
Senator Morgan, and then we do need to... We've got
I'm
two
fine. I don't have a question.
Okay. Right. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'd like to call Chuck Bennett and Gene Wilkinson up those.
Pass me the gavel. You got a hold in the
coaches.
Mr. Bennett.
Representative Morgan, thank you. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Just very briefly, Madam Chair, our issue is really quite simple. It's whether the school children of Oregon will underwrite these commercial activities at 75% or 85%, and that appears to be the issue at stake here for the Common School Fund. We certainly understand that there may be discussion regarding the costs of the program as well as the efficacy of the program, the equity inside the fee structure. But the bottom line for the school kids is they are underwriting the cost of this program substantially. And we support the bill, believing that it results in a little closer to some equity for the Common School Fund as opposed to the current system. These fees have not been changed since 1989. I think you, in your questions, I think arrived at what that looks like when legislators fail to change these fees on a year-by-year basis. There's a sudden change, and it's a sudden increase, but ultimately we think it gets us a little closer to where we need to be. Certainly support the bill very strongly.
And I'm not disagreeing with what you say, because I think that all of us are very focused on the revenue flow into the Common School Fund. But I think another piece of this is that there is an economic development issue here, and the schools also benefit from increased property values and development that takes place on the local level. And so the issue, I think, that has to be looked at here as part of this is what kind of chilling impact you have on that activity by doing this.
Representative Morgan, that would have to be quantified to see it. I can't see in the kinds of numbers we're talking about, frankly, a chilling effect economically. There may well be that I'm not appreciating the it must be incredibly tight margins these folks operate under that would result in the kind of impact you're describing. But ultimately, when you're asking the school children to underwrite this to the tremendous numbers we're asking, I think that at some point there's an equity that just has to be approached. And I don't know what it looks like exactly and where the real chilling effect would occur. But at 85% for the Common School Fund to underwrite this, that seems asking an awful lot. That seems very, very generous from the Common School Fund. And then it's your question as policymakers, what is the fair distribution of costs here? And, you know, whatever you come up with is, I assume, by definition, the fair distribution of that. But we'd suggest to you it's getting a little closer to 75 than 85.
I only heard part of this conversation, but it would seem to me a discussion ought to be, should this be Common School Fund paying for these services, or should it be general fund?
That, yes, Mr. Chairman, that's a certainly a reasonable question. It's one we've raised on other programs as well, where the Common School Fund is the fund of last resort. In this case, though, and it could be either general fund or common school fund, we'd probably be in on a general fund issue as well. We have usually 43% to 45% of the general fund at stake in underwriting the schools in the state as well. So we'd be interested in whether you are going to subsidize commercial activity with the general fund as well. That would be a fairly substantial. Again, this is a question, I think, I mean, just in looking at it and listening to the question, it's a question of, do the beneficiaries and users pay for the program, or do either the people or the school children of Oregon pay for the program? And then I think you start asking questions about economic development, what's fair in that case.
Would it have any bearing at all when you look at the shape of the economy right now? We're trying to encourage people to do things and projects and get moving and establish more employment. To hold off on a fee increase, like some of these huge fee increases, to encourage people to move forward and start developing?
Mr. Chairman, I think you know from previous testimony, we are very, very strong supporters of the natural resource economy, and and the importance it plays in funding local communities and schools. In listening to the numbers, the magnitudes when you talk in percentages, I think, are substantial. That is the failure of the legislature not to increase the fees over time in a regular manner, at least looking at inflation. And when you look at what the change looks like, I'm wrong, and I certainly stand to be corrected, but the numbers we're talking about in absolute amounts don't seem that staggering, that they would make the kind of differences in economic development that would result in real substantial losses. If they are that way, certainly I think that those are worth taking a look at, and I've had the impression the department has been pretty reasonable in those cases. But again, I'm no expert on the equity of the fees themselves, just on what's happening relative to the Common School Fund and our concern there.
Where are we? Representative Johnson, are you next?
I don't know. I don't have any more questions.
Mr. Bennett, I think that you sat through the testimony that this committee heard with respect to the management of the Elliott, did you not? And some of the criticism that was leveled against the department for the cost to the Common School Fund and how little was returned to it. I may be reaching to try to find an analogy here, but it seems to me that there is one, that on the one hand, it's very difficult to be too critical of the agency when they're trying to recoup some of their cost for the operation of a program here, and yet we were quite critical about the lack of return out of the management of the Elliott. Do you have any comment about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, as you'll recall, we joined in that, I think, being critical. We're very concerned. I don't mean to be critical of the division, but concerned that we have, as I recall, I'm just doing these off the top of my head, but I think I'm close, an $800 million asset with a $10 million return on investment, that we're concerned that there's a disproportionate impact on the Common School Fund here and that the costs are substantial in managing the Elliott and the return is low. And I think even then, Mr. Chairman, you asked me about fees, and I suggested then, and I still believe, fees are probably too low in terms of the return to the Common School Fund. Now, there are obviously other policy issues at stake here, but for the school children, they are underwriting an awful lot of activity. This is a fairly new area, and I think I mentioned this in my first testimony to you, a fairly new area for the school lobby to be taking any interest in, and I've been dealing with this for some of the other organizations, and we're just real concerned that the Common School Fund is not being maximized, so we try to keep coming back on each of these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyway, any other questions? I'd like Jean to have some time to testify. Would you like to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll be very brief. As you realize, farmers in Oregon conduct operations, quite a few agriculture-related operations that are governed by Division of State Lands. Some of those activities are exempt, quite a few of them are. Some of those activities will be governed under general authorizations, and some of those activities will require permits from the Division of State Lands. I understand that a certain amount of fee increases is needed and appropriate, and so I'm not up here opposing any fee increases at all, although I'm not an expert and can't even really speak intelligently on this Common School Fund issue and some of these tough budget issues that you're dealing with. But I realize that we are going to be facing fee increases. I do appreciate also what Division of State Lands has done with regard to general authorizations. I think they've made policy decisions to govern some of these small activities through general authorizations, which would just require some criteria on the activities and wouldn't require a permit process, and that would save money and be easier for the activities, the farmers in the state. So I think that that's a good policy area to go, and they have made changes in this bill so that under these general authorizations, a Division of State Lands does not need to do any administrative work that costs money to administer some of these general authorizations, then DSL will not charge fees for that. That sounds fair, that's reasonable, and that's good. We do have concerns about the fee increases, and you've discussed it a lot here and had some excellent discussion. The fee increases are substantial in this bill. Those that, for small operators, have been paying sometimes $50 for their application fee fees in the past, and under this bill, for the base fees, they'd be paying $300. Of course, that's a significant increase. For small operators, some of them for the volume fees would be have been paying $75, and they would be paying $800 or more under this bill. That's going to come as a shock to our membership, especially on the coastal areas and in southern Oregon where a lot of these activities occur. And it may come as a shock to some of your constituents. That's why, of course, we would prefer more of an incremental approach to fee increases rather than these huge hikes that will come as a shock. I don't have a real good handle on how much money needs to be raised for Division of State Lands operations through these fee increases. If a significant amount of money has to be raised, of course, that puts us in a box, and we'll have to figure that out. If there is flexibility there, then definitely incremental approach is going to be preferred. So that's about all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Questions? Said it very well.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? If there is, you would be it. If not, we'll close the public hearing. Committee, obviously, we're not ready to go to the work session on this. Judy, do we know if we have anything else?
I don't think
there is this week.
Yeah, there's nothing else this week.
And so, committee, stay tuned.
Is that the adjournment, please?